This is Josh Dahlke coming back at you with the second episode of the Hunger Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me as we set the table together and share our hunger for hunting and everything it means to be a hunter. In the first episode, I brought you to my family's farm, the place where I became a hunter and gained a lifelong appreciation for the outdoors and the pursuit of these wild animals that we're so lucky to have. Holy smokes, do you ever take a moment to think about what life would be like without wildlife? I think about it all the time, and I know that it would be a sad existence. In fact, I think that's all we'd be doing is just existing. Wildlife and wild places are a gift. And when we unwrap those gifts, we often end up experiencing the most meaningful moments of our lives. What I've been able to experience at Rancho Mababe is a perfect example. About 2 hours south of the Mexican border, somewhere off a long dirt road and through several gates, you'll find Rancho Mababe. Well, the truth is, you'd probably never find it if you weren't a hunter. Gould's Wild Turkeys are what first brought me to Mababe, and I was fortunate to go back a second time to hunt the great ghost, the coos deer. Aside from the magic of connecting with a gorgeous turkey and a buck of a lifetime, I've brought home so many more treasures from Mababe. One of those treasures is the inspirational story of how Alice and Roberto Valenzuela ended up taking over at this ranch. Now, I'm sure many of you have puffed on a few pipe dreams where you end up leaving your day job to go live in the middle of nowhere. Well, that's what these people did. And so I'm excited to sit down with Alice to share that story with all of you. Thanks for joining us for another episode of the Hunger Podcast. Right now I'm sitting here at a place that has become very special to me. It's a ranch south of Douglas, Arizona, in the state of Sonora, Mexico, called Rancho Mababe. And I turkey hunted here for the first time about 3 years ago to kill my Gould's turkey as part of a World Slam. And as an avid turkey hunter, somebody who's just ate up with turkey hunting, coming down here, it was way more than just trying to come down and hunt a different subspecies of wild turkey. It was about being able to experience Mexico for the very first time in my life, but also the very first time as a hunter. And I had no idea what to expect when I came down here. But when I finally made my way through all the gates to get back to this beautiful ranch secluded back in some section of the Sierra Madres, the mountains down here, I became infatuated with this place, and I've been looking forward to come back ever since I first came down here. So I'm back. I'm hunting coos deer, which has been a lifelong dream of mine. And right now I'm sitting here in front of a fire with Alice, and her husband Roberto is just hanging out here in the corner, relaxing after a long day on the ranch. Alice, thanks for joining us on here.
Thanks for having me.
So Alice is fondly known as a nickname. I don't even know if she realizes it's her nickname. But the outfitter who I'm hunting with down here, Ted Jaycox of Tall Tine Outfitters, has referred to Alice several times as the Dos Equis woman, the world's most interesting woman. And I wouldn't say that's far off. Out of all the people I've met, Alice, her stories and her depth of knowledge about all sorts of things. Obscure things, some things that just, you know, tie into the history of the ranch, just you name it. She seems to know more things than your average bear. And so I'm really fortunate to be able to sit down with her right now and talk about a couple of stories that she has shared with me, both on the Mexico Gould's turkey hunt that I did down here, and now this week as I'm hunting coos deer on the ranch. And the first thing I wanted to talk to Alice about and share with you is the incredible story of how her and her husband Roberto ended up down here in the state of Sonora when they were set up pretty damn good in Silicon Valley in California.
Yeah, I guess you could say we had the ideal lifestyle. We had a great house, cappuccinos on the waterfront, thriving careers. My husband was a systems analyst at Hewlett Packard, and I was a newspaper publisher. And we eventually had two children, and raising them in what we thought was a nice neighborhood with all of our Silicon Valley success stories, everybody like us. And if we hadn't had children, we'd probably still be there. I was surprised that as my younger, well, both of my sons, as they were growing, they were only toddlers. But it became obvious to me that because of the place where we lived, you know, the lifestyles of the rich and famous, stuff like that, they were asking for things like designer sneakers when they were 2 years old. And I couldn't get babysitters for my children occasionally. I was paying four times the minimum wage, but the area was so prosperous, all of the teenagers got BMWs when they turned 16, and nobody wanted to work for four times the minimum wage. And we just started wondering whether this was the environment and the values that we wanted to pass on to our children. So, of course, we had always come back to the family ranch during holidays, and we started noticing that we were spending more and more time at the ranch, and we were when we were in Silicon Valley, we kept talking about when's the next time we can go back to the ranch. And after a series of events, like the designer sneaker occasion, we just realized that, you know, we didn't want to live that lifestyle anymore. It had aspects to it that success has its costs, you know, and especially when you're trying to raise children normally in a not normal place where people become billionaires overnight, right? And they think that's normal. So we just did a sort of a soul searching, and we talked about whether it was feasible for us to go to the ranch because, you know, you don't have a regular income. Cattle prices go up and down. It might rain or it might not rain. Then there was an uncertain political situation in Mexico. So we, you know, we risked trading in two thriving careers with pensions and, you know, all of that stuff for a very uncertain lifestyle. And ultimately, it came down to one question after we did all the debates. We said, what's the worst that could happen if we go to the ranch and fail? And you can't just go back to Silicon Valley and get on a career track because all the young Turks move up behind you, and you know, technology changes so often, you're obsolete in 6 months, you know, if you're not keeping up. So the worst thing that could happen is, my husband said, well, I guess the worst thing that could happen is we lose the ranch, we have no job, we lose our savings, and I guess we'll have to clean bathrooms at the San Francisco airport. And
So, before we move on, let's rewind just a little bit and explain what it was that you and Roberto were doing in Silicon Valley that you know, allowed you that lifestyle that you were living that you wanted to get out of.
It was very satisfying on all levels. My husband was a systems analyst at Hewlett Packard, and he was being moved around and up, you know, through the company. And I was a newspaper publisher. I published one of the first newspapers in the San Francisco Bay Area, bilingual paper for the Hispanic, growing Hispanic market. And when the kids came along, I sold the paper and became a stay-at-home mom. The paper is still owned by the fellow I sold it to. And as we started talking about moving to the ranch, we realized we really didn't know much about ranching. And I thought it was a good idea to get a master's in business administration with a focus on agribusiness. And that was offered at Santa Clara University near us. And it was given for working executives. So it was a nighttime program from 5:30 to 10:30 at night. And so I did that. In preparation, we thought, for coming to the ranch. And it turned out that when we moved here, we had to bring to bear to this job all the skills we learned as executives in Silicon Valley, and we had to learn a whole bunch of other stuff, you know, that we had no way of anticipating we needed to know.
So the ranch, let's get a little bit more background on the ranch itself. So you mentioned before that you guys found yourself continually returning here to visit, but whose ranch was it? And how did you guys have access to this ranch? And I mean, it was Roberto's family's, right?
Right. His parents were barely newlyweds, and they started to buy small pieces of what became, you know, the ranch. They would add to it over the years. They started buying it in World War II. It had been owned by a British-Irish fellow who was the British consul in this area, and he formed the Sonoran Land and Timber Company as a foreign investment for European investors who wanted to get in on the cattle market in this area at about 1902. And the ranch had belonged to other people before that briefly, but they couldn't make a go of it. A Frenchman, an American, another Englishman. And he was the one that actually cobbled together what was a 250,000-acre enterprise at the time. And when the Mexican Revolution broke out in 1914, he took his wife and his five kids and the Irish tutor back to England until he thought it would all blow over. It was a peasant uprising against the titled landowners, and he just thought the elite would win and he'd be back. Well, the peasants won, and so he stayed in England. His ranch was expropriated by the Mexican government and the new Mexican government, and he filed a lawsuit with the International Court at the United Nations to be compensated for the loss of his property, the expropriation. He did get a judgment for $50,000 in gold at the time, be about 1918, and but he was never able to collect on that judgment. So he stayed back in England. In that interim, his wife had died, and he remarried a woman, a widow with two children in England, and they never saw the ranch. So when he died, they just started selling off this 250,000-acre enterprise piecemeal. And that's when my in-laws, you know, young, optimistic, poor, but energetic, ambitious, they just started buying pieces, you know, little by little. And that's where my husband grew up. And so that's how we ended up here.
The Hunger Podcast is powered by the Hunt Stand mobile hunting app. You know, it's not all that surprising that Hunt Stand has more users than any other hunting app in the world. Hunt Stand allows you to manage all your hunting locations on an interactive map, and you can keep everything organized so it's way easier to plan your hunts. Weather forecasts, wind mapping, private and public property boundaries, landowner information. Those are just a handful of the features that me and more than a million other hunters use in the Hunt Stand app to make every minute count and be more successful in putting meat on the table. If you haven't already, download the Hunt Stand app for your Android or iOS mobile device. And if I were you, I'd seriously consider upgrading to Hunt Stand Pro. You can save 10% right now if you get it at huntstand.com/huntstandmedia. Once again, that's huntstand.com/huntstandmedia to save 10% off Hunt Stand Pro. Now, let's get back to Alice Valenzuela.
So, you mentioned ambition. Obviously, that is one of many traits you need to have if you're going to take on a ranch like this. And I think it would be great if you could describe to people what the ranch looks like, kind of the layout, how it sits here at the base of the mountains, and just, you know, what type of ranch was this when you guys first set up shop here, or moved in, I should say, and how has it evolved, and what, how are you making this ranch profitable so that you can actually make a living rather than just, I mean, for somebody like me, you show up out here and it's easy because I'm hunting and I'm just visiting and I get to see just a minor snapshot of your lifestyle. But there are a lot of different things going on behind the scenes here. It looks like the most peaceful place on earth. And, you know, we're sitting here next to a beautiful fire right now in this quaint, beautiful home in what's probably the most peaceful place I've ever traveled to. There's a degree of silence out here when you're at the ranch that I don't think I've ever heard silence in this way. Like it's unbelievably peaceful. And, so there's a whole nother side to that and the work that goes into it to maintain a place of the scale. So what was it like when you moved in and how has it evolved into what it is now?
Well, geographically, we are in what is called the high desert of Sonora, and it's a transitional area between desert and mountains. So you will see mesquite trees coexisting with sycamore trees, you know, and cacti coexisting with pine trees. And so that makes for, in ecology, they call it the edge, you know, when two different environments collide or meet. And at the edge effect, there's a lot of biodiversity in plants and animals. And there's also unpredictable weather, too, rainfall and, you know, soil conditions and all of that. So it's a challenging area to ranch in because when they say you get an average of 21 inches of rain a year, that might mean you get 5 inches this year and 30 inches next year and 15 the next, and it kind of averages out to 21 inches. So, it's not real predictable. And in fact, my father-in-law, the first thing he taught my husband is you can't count on anything in this environment. And there are 25-year cycles of wet and drought. And so, and you're trying to manage, a landscape, not just with those environmental challenges, but then also the cattle market, the prices go up and down. And then there are political things. The U.S. might impose import-export duties on cattle. Most of the livestock raised here this close to the border are produced for export to the United States.
Okay, when you say livestock, that can mean a lot of different things to different people. And, most people think of beef cattle, which you guys do have beef cattle here, but you've also got sheep.
Right. We were one of the first people to add sheep to our mix. Cattle really aren't the right fit for this environment, but it's been a tradition since the Spaniards conquered Mexico. They've started big cattle ranches. So we started adding sheep to the enterprise about, 12 or 15 years ago. And these are meat sheep, not wool sheep. So they're raised exclusively for meat, not for wool. They taste different. They act different. They're actually genetically somewhere between a sheep and a goat. They have one more chromosome than a sheep, but one less than a goat. So they're right in the middle. And they're really great for this environment, they're a complement to the cattle. They don't compete a lot with the cattle for, grazing. And it's a way to even out the income stream because the prices don't swing as wildly for sheep as for cattle. Sheep are mostly consumed in the southern part of Mexico, and we're in the north, but increasingly, people are moving from the south to the north because there's more economic opportunity with, the trade agreements between the U.S. and Mexico. Again, a lot of that happens on the edge, on the border between the U.S. and Mexico. And so we're producing sheep for people from the south who enjoy that as part of their culinary, heritage. And we can control the prices. We're not price takers like you are with cattle. We're more price makers with the sheep. And we're always looking for other enterprises to add to the ranch because it's a diverse environment and there's a lot of potential here that isn't being tapped. So we don't want to do things like logging, although that's been proposed. We had narrowed it down when we looked at the whole range of enterprises we could add to the sheep and the cattle. We narrowed it down to birding, bird watching, and hunting. And we felt that we couldn't do both well at the same time. So we had to pick one. We thought, let's get good at it. And then maybe we'll add the other one at a future point. And you've heard the story about how we got into hunting. It's been such a positive experience for us because of hunters. Neither of us are hunters, and we were originally not very receptive to the idea of hunting.
Yeah. So let's talk more about that. You mentioned that today at lunch that, originally, you know, you thought of somebody coming out here and deer hunting, and you thought of a deer hunter, and you had a notion of what that was going to be like already embedded in you. And you learned quickly that it was quite the contrary. So what do you think? Well, first of all, let's hear about what you originally did think about hunters, what your supposition was.
Well, the reason we even thought of hunting was because my husband uses a holistic management model to manage the landscape and the animals. And we were the subject of many agronomy engineers' PhD theses, and they would come out and sample the water and the forage and, you know, the density of rabbits and stuff like that. And they came to us and they said, you know, you have a really healthy coos deer population, much more than even right over the fence line where your neighbors are. You've created this habitat, you're attracting them. And they said, you need a hunting business. And I said, I don't think I could shoot Bambi. You know, I mean, I'm from the California tree hugging, you know, background. And they said, well, Senora, you're going to have to shoot something because you have a grocery store for mountain lions. There are so many deer here. You're going to be pulling lions in before too long. And when you have 4 and 6 year old kids scampering around the countryside alone, you never think about that they might be lunch for a mountain lion. So that was just, as a mom, that was an incentive for me to consider hunting, you know. And they said, well, you're managing your livestock population, and deer can be managed as a resource in the same way. And the difference is people will pay you to hunt deer, but you will have to pay someone to shoot mountain lions, you know, predator control. So I'm a former investigative newspaper reporter, and I like to say that makes me an information junkie. So before we didn't just jump into it. I spent 3 years researching. That was a little overboard. That's me. Very type A. And so we visited ranches that had hunting as part of their business model. We went to trade shows like the Safari Club International. I started reading all the hunting magazines and, you know, just trying to get a picture of what this looks like. And finally, it just came down to let's invite a group of hunters here and a group of birders on two separate occasions. And we will give them for free the service that we would propose to offer as a business. And so the birders were first. You know, I was in favor more of the birders. I thought this was low impact and, you know, you're not shooting Bambi. And, you know, more nice. And it was actually surprising to me how frustrated I was by the experience, because the birders just kind of glassed. They were looking for birds, and then they just checked the birds off their list. And I would be walking around, and I'm real excited to live here. I still am. And I'd say things like, you see that giant cottonwood tree over there? That tree needs 300 gallons of water a day to survive. But do you see any water near that cottonwood tree? No, it's in a dry, you know, riverbed. Well, what do you think's happening? Where is it getting the 300 gallons of water? And they just look at you like clueless and disinterested. That was it. Not just clueless, but disinterested. And everywhere I went, I was trying to point out all the wonderful things there are here, you know. They just wanted to glass birds and check them off the list. And I felt emotionally exhausted when they left because I was trying so hard to get them to be enthusiastic and interested. Because this is a wonderful place, you know, and I wanted other people to enjoy that. It wasn't just about having a business and collecting a check. It's got to be the whole experience, right? Because we did that in Silicon Valley. We had a, you know, after a while, it's not, the money isn't enough. There has to be something else, more meaning. And so then we invited three hunters out. And we offered them the room and board, and, you know, got the tags and the arms permits. And I said, and I want to go out with you. I want to see what you guys do, because after all, it's Bambi.
Right? And so with these three hunters, where did you find them? And, you know, what did you, were you anticipating what you would regard as failure in that? I mean, you had these birders out. You weren't very happy with how that went. Now you're going to have these hunters out. Did you expect even worse results from the hunters?
I just didn't think, I thought it would be the same. Maybe I just wasn't excited about hunting, and I thought I would be excited about birding. We are in one of the top five prime birding sites in North America, right here on my ranch. 4 million birds migrate across my ranch every year with 300 and some species. And I really wanted to be excited about birding, and I didn't want to be excited about hunting. So I wasn't expecting anything particularly negative from hunters, but I just personally wasn't excited about the idea of hunting, because all I could think of was Bambi, you know? And so they were friends of fellow ranchers in Arizona. And I said, you know, send me three people who are going to be, you know, respectful and just enthusiastic about hunting. Just someone who would be like a typical group of hunters. And when they came, I explained, it's everything's free, but I want to go out with you. I want to see what you're doing out there, you know.
And what was their reaction to that?
And they said that was cool. I thought that was interesting, because it's three guys and I'm, you know, a middle-aged lady. And so I got up with them, you know, every morning for 3 days of the 5-day hunt. And they stuck binoculars in my, you know, they just showed me what they did, how they did it, why they did it. And then I didn't stay the whole 5 days, because I had to be home cooking for them, right? And keeping their fires burning and all. And it was very surprising. First of all, you could feel the energy between them about how excited they were just to be out. And the deer only, it almost seemed like the deer were secondary. Of course they were there for their trophy bucks, but if you just drove them up and said, here's a trophy buck, and they got them and went home, that wouldn't have been any fun. I mean, they were into the whole thing. And when I'd say the same thing, see that black walnut tree over there? You know, and do you know, they really? You know, they wanted to know more about everything, not just show me the deer. And that, it was physically exhausting for me to traipse up the mountains and down and get up at 4 a.m.
But it was emotionally fulfilling.
It was emotionally so satisfying, and that they were excited. It made me want to try harder too, you know? And so the part that surprised me was at the end, and they all got their bucks. So at the end of the 5-day hunt, they leave on the 6th day, and they said, well, what do you think? Because they knew they were a trial group. They knew we hadn't decided on hunting at all. And I thought birding was going to be the default, because I just was not excited about the idea of hunting. And they said, well, what did you think? What did you think? And I like to think back to those psychology tests where if I say black to you, what's the first word that pops into your mind? Black, white, you know, big, little. And they said, what did you think? And I was surprised that what came out of me, I said, it's beautiful. And I looked at myself, I said that? And I'm still surprised that I said that, but it was beautiful. And it was because of them. It was just because of why they were excited about hunting, and they were patient explaining why, and they were, even if they had not gotten their bucks, they would have still been excited to be here. And that was it. We've had a couple of trial groups of birders in since then, and we would love to add birding still, but we can't find birding outfitters the way with as much, you know, commitment and enthusiasm and mission as we have had with you know, our hunting outfitters and the hunters.
It's amazing to me, because I run into it so often where I meet people who are non-hunters, and, you know, they ask me about it, and it's gotten to the point now where it's, when it comes up, I'm reluctant to even have that conversation, just because I've experienced so many times where somebody asks about it, they act like they're interested, They want to know more. They want to give it the benefit of the doubt. But then when I start explaining it and I get excited about it, they kind of just tune out and move on and change the conversation or whatever. And for me, that's difficult because I am so passionate about it. So to have to explain this to somebody and then get into it and then realize that, you know, they really didn't care that much in the first place. Kind of like how you mentioned, it's emotionally exhausting. Your experience with the birders, I totally get that, because when you don't see that fire in somebody about something that you care about so much, it's a downer.
It's a downer.
It is. It's a downer.
Yeah. And so you guys work hard out there, you know, because a coos is a tough trophy. I didn't know. We still don't hunt. We're not particularly interested in hunting, but we're really excited to see people come out and hunt. And a lot of people, when they come, it's their first coos. And it's, you know, the coos is a smaller subspecies of the North American whitetail. So the males top out at maybe 90 pounds, maybe 95 pounds, but the racks are really big in proportion to their body size. And a lot of people, and we tell them before they hunt, you have to be able to drop a buck at least 350 yards. It's not, you know, they're very astute and aware. And again, with the brush and the cover we have here in the Sierra Madre Mountains, they call them the gray ghost of Sonora, is what they call the deer. They're a tough hunt. And so it's a challenge. And we like to see people, you know, meet that challenge. And you just work so hard. And when you get the trophy, I feel like a cheerleader. I want to cheer everybody because it's a tough hunt, and you really deserve, you know, to get those bucks.
I know today, after I was fortunate to shoot my deer on day four this morning, you were a cheerleader. You came out to the meat pole and the guys were working on the animal, and you were really genuinely excited for me. And that type of thing means a lot to a hunter, because, you know, it's great to have an outsider per se recognize, yeah, it does take a lot of work, and there's so much that goes into it, from skills and knowledge and just strategy and how you do things day to day.
Endurance.
Yeah, there's
it's just everything.
It takes, in some cases, it takes everything you have as a human in order to be successful as a hunter. And I have to tell you, I've hunted a lot of different animals around the country and even around the world. And I've done a lot of spotting and stalking, which is what coos deer hunting primarily is. It's hours behind the glass, binoculars, spotting scopes. And we've been hunting dark to dark every day. And that's what you have to do to even have a chance to take one of these animals. So I was extremely humbled by the coos deer. This is my first chance to hunt them. I've been dreaming about it for a long time. And what you said about the gray ghost, I've heard that so many different times in articles and on TV shows and just exchanging stories with other people who have hunted them or know something about them. And I've always thought it's a little bit of a cliche, because a lot of species get a great amount of credit for their quirks and how difficult they can be. And, you know, depending on the environment they live in and their habits, and you know, every animal gets respect in its own right for being a challenge. But for a spot and stalk hunter, the coos deer is unlike anything I've experienced. And until you actually get out here and have your boots on the ground and you try to go after them, there's just no way to put it into words or explain it. Even with the glassing aspect of it, you know, it's known, or it's commonly spoken about regarding coos deer hunting, you know, spending hours behind the glass. Well, until you spend hours behind the glass, you don't even know what that feels like or what that exactly means. And that in itself is exhausting. You get eye fatigue. It wears you out. You got wind blasting you in the face all day. You got sun burning you. And you're just sitting there looking through these little pieces of glass, scanning and picking apart the countryside to find this tiny deer that can escape in the blink of an eye and you never see it again, because there's so much cover. And because they're so small, it doesn't take much for them to disappear. So,
and you earn it. When you bring those bucks back, you earn it. And we do, the word is rejoice. We just rejoice with you because I only went on one hunt, you know, and that was enough to really earn my respect for what you all do when you come. And we look forward to it every year. And none of the hunters is anything like this impression that I had before. You know, I thought it was going to be a bunch of drunk guys in the woods just shooting everything that moved. And somebody told me a story about somebody made a fortune selling camouflage toilet paper. If you remember why they would invent camera, you know, shoot anything that moves, you know. And so it was totally unexpected, the experience that we had. And again, I expected not to want to do hunting as opposed to birding. And you guys changed our minds. It was just the way you are. And so I still feel the glow of that every time somebody brings a buck. I really like it when people get what they come for.
A couple other things I want to talk about real quick just before we wrap up. Obviously, we're here south of the border. I can say that as an American. You guys live here full time, so south of the border for you would be what? What's
Guatemala, maybe?
Yeah. I don't know. So here in Mexico, where we are right now, we're in a rural area, if you'd like to call it that. It's a secluded ranch, well off the beaten path. It takes, what, 40 minutes off the nearest
paved road. Off the 45 paved road. Minutes,
Go through multiple gates. We're out here in just about as middle of nowhere as you could possibly get these days, anywhere in the world, to be honest. There's a lot of these deer out here, I can guarantee you, have never seen a human being. And that's not something you can find in many parts of the world anymore, but this is a part of the world where that is the case. Now, just 2 hours north of us is Agua Prieta border town. And just on the other side of the border on the American side is Douglas. And so, of course, with a lot of the media and the sensationalism and the things that we hear on the news and whatnot, I've even encountered a lot with personally with telling people, hey, I'm going to be going down to Sonora to hunt coos deer. You know, the first reaction that you normally get from the average person is, you know, questioning whether you're going to be safe. And I'd love to hear your take on that. I mean, you live down here in, like I said before, probably the most peaceful chunk of heaven that I've ever visited in my life. Yet 2 hours north is the border, and what we see on TV isn't necessarily the full picture, right?
Right. Well, as a former newspaper reporter and publisher and editor, we all know that headlines sell newspapers. And so you tend to focus on the things that aren't ordinary. I can only say I've lived here for 29 years since we left Silicon Valley. And I travel alone on the back roads in my four-wheel drive, and I've broken down several times, you know, on these back roads. They're not usually graded. And so I have to walk. I've walked 10, 15 miles for help, you know, over the years. And I've never once had an incident, not anything close. I guess I would say it would be like someone from France saying, I'm not going to go to the U.S. because Detroit is dangerous. But, you know, so I'm not going to go to Mexico because, you know, certain regions have their reputations. And most of Mexico gets painted with that broad brush, and it's not accurate. But it does sell newspapers. Well, I guess not today. Nobody reads newspapers, but it gets headlines.
It makes its way through the 24-hour news cycle and our Facebook and our Instagram feeds that, you know, somebody learned something and 10 seconds later, they already forgot it. But yeah, you're right. Sensationalism and headlines sell news and drive ratings and that sort of thing. So, I mean, obviously there are certain things going on the border, but there's also things going on 20 minutes from my house in Minneapolis where you can go online to the Minneapolis Police Department, and you can literally look at an interactive map that shows real-time reports of where gunfire is happening. So, I mean, it's all relative, and you really have to put it in perspective, but geez, I would really, really hate to somewhere in the next life have to look back and realize that I never came to a place like this just because maybe there's a little bit of turmoil going on
somewhere else
in certain areas. Yeah. I mean, I feel like as an American, a lot of times folks generalize Mexico as if it's like a city, you know? I mean, it's a gigantic tract of land. It's a big country. And to just attach the name Mexico to any negative news that's occurring or any negative events, it's really just a pretty narrow perspective.
Well, also, I think most people don't realize that hunting, particular American hunters coming to Mexico, is a big source of revenue for Mexico. Tourism is its biggest whatever enterprise, I guess, as a country, more than the oil that they produce and export and other activities. So I think a lot of Americans know that that's not true, because the income, the bottom line shows. People keep coming. They like it. They like their experience. And, here we are. And I'm really glad you guys keep coming back.
Me too. And what I'd like to end with is another reason I love coming back is the cooking. And, you fire up that stove in the kitchen every day with wood that is cut right here on the ranch. And so for those of you who are listening, I don't know how many places you've been where, folks are actually cooking with fire, unless you're talking about like a newer fancy restaurant or a wood fire pizza place where it's just kind of a trendy deal. But down here, they heat with wood, they cook with wood, and the byproduct of cooking with wood can be some tremendous flavor. And what I wanted to have you maybe talk a little bit about before we wrap this up is the wild game, the coos deer, the wild turkeys. How did you get introduced to cooking wild game, and how did you get so damn good at it? Because we've eaten some good stuff when I've been here so far, including the sheep, which are just,
lamb.
the lamb that they're probably about 50 yards out the window right now, behind a fence, and they're butchered right here on site. They're grown here on site. That's delicious too. But as a huge proponent of eating wild game, I'd love to hear about how you ended up getting familiar with that.
Well, as background, on my mother's side of the family, my grandparents had his and hers diners in Reading, Pennsylvania once upon a time. So we all grew up cooking. And my dad was a doctor in the Army, and he took us all over the world, on his various assignments. So we ate internationally, and we've eaten some very odd stuff, because I guess we've always cooked and we've always eaten everything. It was a learning curve for me when I came here. I had to learn to cook on a wood-burning stove and bake in a stove where the temperatures aren't as controllable. And I guess I just owe it to a lot of wild game cookbooks, and just you keep trying. And then I don't grill. I leave the grilling to the hunters because they do it better than me. But it's just, again, a byproduct of that enthusiasm that you bring to hunting. And so it just makes me, you work so hard for that buck. And if it doesn't taste good on your plate, I feel devastated. So the incentive was very strong to learn to cook it well.
Well, we're going to wrap this up. And just so you know, I'll be firing up couple front shoulders of the coos deer that I shot this morning. I'm going to cook those tomorrow for everybody, so we'll have those as part of the main course for dinner. And again, I just wanted to thank you for coming on the podcast, telling some great stories. Hopefully next time I come back, we can do this again. And there's at least, I don't even know, a dozen or 20 more stories that I've heard from you that I'd really love to share with the listeners. But for now, we're going to wrap it up. This is the Hunger Podcast. We'll see you back here next time and have a good day.
How incredible is that? You know, every last detail of Alice and Roberto's story is like something out of a movie. But I didn't have to go to a movie theater to see this story. All I had to do was go hunting. Thanks again for listening to this episode of the Hunger Podcast. No matter what platform you're using to listen to the podcast, please take the time to subscribe and leave a review. And as always, you can reach me directly at The Hunger Official on Instagram. And make sure you do not miss the next episode. I'll be sitting down with my hunting buddy, Brad Fitzpatrick, to give you our firsthand accounts of crossing the border and hunting coos deer in the middle of nowhere, Mexico. See you then.